You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 433. When given an opportunity, deliver excellence and never quit. Robert Rodriguez.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari.
Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Now, guys, today on the show, we have John Hess from Filmmaker IQ. Now, I've been a fan of John's work for years. Filmmaker IQ is an amazing website with these remarkable mini documentaries that he puts up on YouTube. And he just shows you everything from how to make air-powered blub squibs to the history of the mockbuster, the fundamental elements of film music, who's in a movie credits, the science of deep focus and hyperfocal distance. I mean, the history of the Hollywood musical. He goes deep into each topic he covers, and they are so entertaining, so well-produced. I just love what John has been doing over the years. He is definitely an OG in this space of helping filmmakers follow their dreams and make their movies. So I just had an absolute ball talking to John on the show. I can't wait to share this episode with you. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with John Hess. I'd like to welcome to the show the legendary John Hess from Filmmaker IQ. Thank you, John, for being on the show, bud.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I appreciate it, man. I mean, listen, I've been, like I was telling you earlier, I have been a big fan of Filmmaker IQ and what you do. You have a very unique voice and how you approach the filmmaking process and the work that you do with Filmmaker IQ than anybody else in our space. And I've been an admirer from a distance for quite some time. You are, I like to call you, there's a few of you guys, but like the OGs. You're one of the OGs.
Oh, okay.
One of the original gangsters doing this, because it started in 08, right?
Yeah, the site started in 08, I believe. Yeah, I guess so. And I haven't really thought about that. but it was at the tail end of the MySpace era. So if you want to put a context to that.
Oh, yeah. I made a lot of money on MySpace selling my independent film. I was huge on MySpace, huge.
MySpace was, I mean, we were talking like a bunch of old guys sitting around talking about the old days.
Yeah.
But yeah, MySpace was kind of how I got into the whole discussing film online. Mm-hmm. And it was through the MySpace film forums. That's really kind of how IQ started. It was born there. Mm-hmm. It's a long story behind it. I don't know if you want to get into it, but it basically was we were kind of kicked off of MySpace. So we were both, my friend and I, Dennis, we were both banned from MySpace. And we said,
why?
Hey, let's start our own site. Because we for the longest time we didn't have moderators on the film forums, and then we've been clamoring, let's get some moderators because there's probably people in here spamming constantly. Mm-hmm. Well, my friend Dennis would always post very interesting articles, but he would bump the posts up to get them back to the top. He would post an article, but he would bump it up, and that was against the rules, you know, the moderators. So they banned him. One of the more, you know, important assets of the film forums was banned because he would bump up his old posts, and that's. So he said, and I fought for him, and I got banned as well, and to hell with MySpace, and we went off to do our own site.
Well, and arguably that worked out for you, okay? Because not many people talk about MySpace anymore. Is it still around? I know it is still on. It's still around,
it's
right?
It's still on for, I guess there's some bands that use it, you know, or some music, and the music scene still kind of uses it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know.
I mean, I think SoundCloud is probably bigger than that.
Way more. No, I mean, MySpace is probably dead. Yeah,
and I think who bought Fox? Fox paid like $1 billion for it.
Mm-hmm. Rupert Murdoch back in the day. Yeah, Tom Anderson had a nice little payday. He was everybody's friend. If you remember
Tom? Tom. So before we get going, man, how did you get into the business? How did you get into to loving what you do?
Oh well, you know. It's to say you love it, you know, it's complicated to say you love what you do. I mean, I love it so much that I'm willing to put up with all the crap that I do.
Amen, brother. Preach.
You know, it's not that I love every single waking day moment. No, I honestly am frustrated half the time, but I wouldn't do it if I didn't love it, I'd be doing something else. So I started off. I made little videos, and I was class of 2000. So I grew up in the late 90s. And I made little videos for my high school. We just is a budding, you know, TV video production class. And I started doing just little projects, advertising on the morning announcements because we had a closed circuit television back in those days, advertising the academic decathlon team. So I started making spoofs of things. I made like a silent film spoof. I made a Titanic, which was really big back then, spoof. I made a Mission Impossible spoof, which is, again, another movie franchise from the late 90s. And I kind of like – I started falling in love with the whole process of just making moving pictures. It's kind of like that's – if you heard Spielberg talk about how he's got started, how when he was a kid he had the little 8 millimeter camera and he would shoot two trains running into each other, and he learned he could just shoot it and watch it over and over again. That's kind of the same way I got into video making or filmmaking, is just I like creating things and just watching them over and over again. I kind of fell in love with that. But as a kid, I always wanted to be in business. I've always, because my father was international engineering, so I was always involved with some sort of I always loved the air of business. So I went to school to be a business major, and I found I still like business, but I was like, I still want to make videos. That's still what I want to do. So about my second year of college, I decided, hey, I'm going to go intern. I want to see if I can marry the two, become a business and video, maybe like a producer in film. So I found a small cable company that was out in Corona, California, and they were doing commercials, like local cable commercials. You know, it was really bad, Cal Worthington kind of style.
Sunday.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So I interned there for like a year. Like I just did it because, and like I didn't even take class credit because I was like, I don't want to do the paperwork for the credit. I just wanted to be there and hang out and do like these little movies, not movies, little commercials. I did that for a year, and I mean I'm going more detail than I probably need to, but I did that for a year and then I was laid off by the company, and the people that I worked with were laid off, and I kind of burned in me this little independent streak. Like, man, these guys I know work for the company for 25 years. They built a family. They depend on this job, and the corporate culture comes in and just kind of axes them. And I'm like, I don't want to go work for the man. So that's when I decided to start doing my own business. And that was about 20 years ago, or 18 years ago, 17, 18 years ago.
And what was that business?
Oh, what do you mean? My own business? Just video production.
Okay.
So any kind of video production. In fact, I do. That's primarily what I do. I mean, the film, narrative filmmaking is something that I want to aspire to more. Mm-hmm. But right now, I'm actually doing a ton of video work for I do work for cities and corporations that call me in to do like a documentary about, you know, their corporate culture, whatever they want to promote. Mm-hmm. So I ended up still using that business education of mine, the business marketing. but I make commercials and stuff like that.
So Filmmaker IQ more was a side, kind of like a side hustle for, and more of a labor of love for.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's honestly a labor of love kind of thing. It's, I mean, I like to kind of push it more toward an actual productive income generating stream. It's, it really is still more of a labor of love. And I don't know, it's one of those things where I don't want to kill it by making it too much of a job necessarily. Although I do want to do something to it. You know, I do want to actually make it to be more of a job, I guess.
Right.
If you want to call it that. I mean, I guess I'm being very candid and honest. All the people breaking their spells about who I am and what I do.
Well, you know, there's a lot of, you know, and I've been doing this for 5 years, and I still say that I have the original filmmaking tutorial on YouTube. Mm-hmm. It was in 2005. I put up behind the scenes of my short film that's still up there. So I was one of the first to do that, but I never kept going with it. So a couple other guys like Film Riot and Ryan and those guys did it, and Rocket Jump and those guys. But a lot of people think that they have a different perception. Like because of how good you do what you do, the perception of what you do is like, oh, he's just, you know, this is amazing. And he's just killing it, and he's just rolling in it. And it's like, a lot of people think that of me as well. Like, oh, he must be just killing. I'm like, you know what? I do okay.
Yeah.
But I'm not Scrooge McDucking it anytime.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
I may be even wrong, but like, I think even someone like Martin Scorsese, who is all intents and purposes hugely successful, he still has trouble. He still has problems making the movie he wants to make half the time. You know, he's always complaining, like, I can't get the money to do this.
Well, to be fair, Marty's not going after $200,000 or $300,000. He's going after $200 million to make a movie that doesn't have a lot of marketability.
You have that, you know, you just hit on exactly how I feel about the situation. Yeah, if he would just go for like a $10 million movie, you know, get some people he's never worked with before, he could get that money in an instant.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, there's different, like Spike Lee, Woody Allen, and those kind of. I mean, Woody, you know, regardless of his personal life as a filmmaker, he did something that I don't think there is another filmmaker of his generation did. He made a movie a year for like 30 years. And he always kept his budget because he knew his art, his films had a specific audience that could generate a certain amount of money, and he would be able to attract huge stars to come in and work scale for him because he was who he was, and he built that kind of system up for himself. And I don't think, I mean, maybe Clint is another guy that I would throw in that, but that's a different generation. That's a whole different other world.
Yeah.
But that's what they were smart. Even Clint, like, you know, he did that. What was that last movie he did with, the bomber?
Richard Jewell.
Yeah. Richard Jewell. Yeah. I don't think Richard Jewell costs 150. I don't think it did cost 150 because Clint knows, like, you know, I'm going to make a movie about Richard Jewell and it's called Richard Jewell. Like, people are like, what? Who else in Hollywood in a studio is making Richard Jewell?
With a schlubby lead actor. It's like, I'm going to put a schlubby guy on the front.
Who no one knows. Like, it's not a face that people recognize. Yeah. So, but he's Clint. But he's smart. Like, there's a budget range that makes sense for that movie. Marty still hasn't figured that out yet.
No. You know, that's... It's funny that you're articulating, like, one... I feel like I was a lone voice back when... what's the movie that Martin...
Irishman.
Finished? Irishman. Yeah. Like, Irishman costs almost as much as Spider-Man Homecoming. You know, like, how can you... And that should be like, if people, well, that's because we spend too much money on comic book movies. Well, there's a bigger audience for the comic book movie. You know, it's Spider-Man. So I don't know. That whole thing was, you could just smell the marketing. I'm a business major. You could feel it, you know, coming at you.
No, exactly. And if you look at someone like Nolan, who also, you know, has a very expensive palette, but his films are for a very broad audience, even though like Inception, it makes my head hurt. It makes everyone's head hurt. Like, thinking about the plotting in that film is pretty insane. But for whatever, but he brings in action. He brings in stars. Mm-hmm. Like, he understands his art form very well. Where Fincher has a little bit of that Scorsese vibe to him, which is like, you know, I really need $150 million. But, and they're like, Fincher, we love you, man, but We can't.
Yeah, no. I love the fact that we're talking about this, because it you know, like, so much of what I see online is kind of like, just give these guys Martin Scorsese $200 million because he deserves it. It's like, that's not how. Yeah,
that's not business.
Put your money into it first. If you had $200 million, put your dollar up in it. It's like, no.
So everyone we're talking about here, we're all talking about giants. So Martin, you know, right. Marty and Nolan and Fincher and all these kind of guys. They're just giants. They live on Mount Hollywood. I call it Mount Hollywood, where they're the gods, the Olympic, the Greek gods of Hollywood. And we're just the peasants throwing up stones. And I'm not throwing up stones at all, because I'm huge fans of all of them. And believe me, if it was up to me, I would give Marty $500 million because I would love to see what he does with that. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that on a business standpoint, it makes no sense. You have to have – if you're going to create a product – and I know a lot of filmmakers out there are going to go, film's not a product. I hate to tell you, it is.
It is.
So if you're going to have a product, that product has to have a cost, and there has to be an ROI, return on investment. Now, if you want to do art films, you make that $5 million or that Woody Allen budget range film and do whatever the hell you want, like whatever you want, because you'll make your money back, because the ROI on a film like that makes sense for a filmmaker of that caliber. But if not, then no. Like, look, Spielberg couldn't get Lincoln financed, you know?
Yeah.
It's Steven Spielberg with Daniel Day-Lewis as a star and couldn't get financing for Lincoln. Then the reason why he couldn't get that was because the ROI essentially didn't look like, who's going to go see a movie about Lincoln, and like, what's the budget range? Is it going to make sense?
And the way Spielberg was selling this movie, Lincoln, he was saying this is going to be a courtroom drama about the 14th Amendment.
So it wasn't great marketing at all.
that's like, oh yeah, that's summer block. That's a popcorn movie right there, right?
Right. But someone of like one of the greatest filmmakers of all time, one of the most successful filmmakers of all time, couldn't get financing for a film. And it wasn't like he was asking for Marty numbers, because Marty, you know, is Marty. He was still asking for, you know, 70, 80 million, 90 million to make this kind of period piece film. He had to go to India to get the money. And they were just like, they were just happy to be making a movie with Spielberg. They're like, here's a check. And it worked out for him. And now Netflix is doing the same thing with Marty. I think they're doing his next movie with Leonardo DiCaprio. So, but that business model is different though. Irishman made sense in the Netflix ecosystem.
Uh-huh.
It made all the sense in the world to spend $150, $180 million in the Netflix ecosystem. In the Hollywood studio system, it makes absolutely no sense. It's just not fine. It just makes no sense. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know much. I don't know enough about the Netflix world. I mean, to me, the Netflix streaming stuff is still so speculative. No one knows exactly what the numbers are. I mean, and then they purposely hide that. So I don't know. I mean, but I just know that Netflix is raising so much capital to make new properties. And part of me is like, well, why can't I get a piece of that action?
If we could go down the Netflix a hole for a second, which from what I'm hearing about Netflix is, well, I know for a fact that they're extremely in debt. In debt, because they've had this kind of, don't forget, they were not a studio. They're a Silicon Valley startup. So they they brought their entire business model as a Silicon Valley startup, meaning spend a lot of money, lose money for a long time to gain market share. And then you'll be at the Amazon model, the Facebook model, every big Airbnb model, all of those kind of models. Then it became a studio afterwards. But you know, they're, I don't know, man. Everything's just like we were talking about earlier. Is like, it doesn't, from what outside we look like we're Scrooge McDucking it. Netflix is the same thing. I think a lot of people have a different perception of Netflix as like, oh, they're just killing it. They're hurting. I don't know if you knew it or not, but, and this is now, we're getting into a little bit of tech geek stuff.
Sure.
Since the pandemic, Netflix has been extremely hurting because more people are watching Netflix.
Yeah.
So the load on their servers and the technology and the cost of that has, I think, tripled. But there are no new subscribers to offset that. So that's just – so now they're just like, oh, man, we've got this. Everyone's watching Netflix now. great. Unfortunately, our business model is not set up for that. We just want a few people to be watching Netflix and pay for it, but don't watch it. And that's what happened. So they actually started throttling. I don't know if you knew that they started throttling the image quality just a bit, because if they drop it 5%, that could be millions of dollars in service fees. Right. So that's one of the things enough. But enough about
it. I buy it. No, yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. It's interesting to think about it. You know, because yeah, like people who are losing their jobs are not getting new Netflix subscriptions.
No, so and there is
have them.
And there's also a level of critical mass when there are no more subscribers that they can get, but yet they're going to have to keep spending Irishman style money for projects to keep what they have, because now Disney's out that brings me to another question I want to talk to you about. You know, Disney Plus and the whole COVID situation and what happened, and you know, Disney is already at over 60 million as of this recording subscribers, which it got in less than a year. It's insane. Now they're doing Mulan, so they're skipping theatrical. What do you think about that whole $30, you've got to be a member of Disney Plus to watch it, and it's an experiment. It's literally, they're doing a $150 million experiment, which is what I was saying when everyone was talking about Trolls 2, like, oh, Trolls 2 killed it. I'm like, dude, it's Trolls 2. It was the first like month of the quarantine. Everybody, there's kids at home. Nobody knew what to do. Of course, they're going to spend $20 on Trolls 2. But I want to see a tentpole. Mulan is a tentpole. What do you think is going to happen? What's your thoughts on it?
Oh, that's a, you know, I hate the cliche. Be interesting to see, because it's like you can say that about everything. I think it will probably do well. This, it's hard to say because we're in such a weird time right now, because we can't go to the movie theaters, so theatrical is not even an option for them. As far as what I think is gonna, I mean, I think it's an extra experiment, but I'm not sure you can be repeated in next year when theaters do eventually open up again. Can you do that? Can you see that same kind of success if people have the option to go back to theater? And again, I know theater is also one of those topics that people feel it's very weird that every time I bring up theater, like on social media or theatrical on social media, there's a group of people that want to see it die. I don't understand why. You notice that?
I have noticed that people are like, it's dead. And I've even said it. I've said it many times. And like, I personally think that the theatrical experience as we knew it in January 2020 will not return to that level probably ever again. We will never have as many screens like that again, because it was all going in a slow downward trajectory. I mean, theatrical attendance and things. It's just what's happening, and regardless if you love it or not, I think there'll always be a theatrical, like there's Broadway plays. Yeah. There's always going to be a movie theater. There's always going to be IMAX. There's going to be an experience like that. But it's never going to die. People still want to go out and do that. But the business model is going to change. So now Disney could just go, you know what, guys, we're just going to release this for 3 weeks, and then we're going to go straight to Disney Plus. And if you don't like it, we'll just go straight to Disney Plus, because we'll probably make enough money to cover that.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you followed, the courts just have overturn that Paramount decree. Mm-hmm. So, which I think, you know, people are jumping over head like, how can we do this? I think the Paramount decrees are kind of long and done, because they were made at a point when movies had only radio as a competition. It was 1948.
Right.
You know, television was 50s. So television came in and kind of beat the crap out of movies. And now we've got internet streaming, which, let's face it, most people are probably doing instead of watching movies. So I think the time for a business model shift is probably here. So like what you're saying, as far as Disney, maybe Disney ends up buying a bunch of theaters where they become like Disney.
Or like the Egyptian here. No, El Capitan. They have El Capitan here.
Yeah, that's Disney. So maybe that happens in like St. Louis now. They have the Disney El Capitan in St. Louis or wherever, Toledo. You know, and then that's all they do is they show Disney movies. And I'm not a parent, but imagine if I was a parent, heck, I'd take my kid to the Disney theater once in a while. I mean, it might be something that's worth pursuing.
And don't forget, there will be a Disney store inside that Disney theater.
Exactly.
I mean, and so for them, it's almost a loss leader to get you in the door to watch the movie because they're going to sell you on other stuff. I mean, it's the truth. And it's the only way, like, I agree with you 100%. I think that theaters, someone's going to buy AMC before the year is out. If not this year, end of next year, or sometime in early next year, someone's going to buy. Amazon's already circling. There's a lot of people with a lot of cash who could just come in and buy it. And all of a sudden you have how many screens all around the country? So, right. and there's so many Regal and all these other things. They're hurting and they're going to be vulnerable for purchase. I agree with you. There's only three major studios that have the power to do anything like that, that have the financial power to do that, which would be Disney, Warner's, and Universal. But the big unknowns, Facebook. Cash, yeah. Google, Amazon, Apple. They have Apple has.
Oh yeah,
$400 billion it. Cash.
Yeah,
hey, just cash.
And well, an iPhone, Apple Store in every theater.
No, I mean, so that is, but that's the key to this. It's this kind of creating of this ecosystem. The Disney's been. I mean, that's what Disney does. Disney, mm-hmm. that's, I mean, they're theme parks, they're cruises, yeah. they're Disney stores. It's what they do. So there's no doubt that there's going to be a Disney chain. I mean, it just makes all the sense in the world.
Mm-hmm. And in that world where we have the internet streaming, I don't see that as a bad thing because it's not, I don't feel like it's stifling competition because mm-hmm. it's not like these indie movies are getting into those big chains anyway. So I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think you're absolutely right. I mean, yeah, AMC. I mean, yeah, some, but not like really indie movies. The theatrical experience for independent film is almost non-existent unless you really are at the top 1% of all independent yeah. films. Whether either you've got a tastemaker like Sundance or South by or an A24 or someone like that, Neon, one of these guys that can kind of come in and elevate the art house vibe. And there are small movies that could do that. And you have to really understand how you do marketing and audience building and all that kind of stuff. But for like the standard, you know, 100,000. Yeah.
And no, they're also like these independent wings and these major studios that, cause I mean, if you're Fox Atom or whatever, you know, Searchlight Studios or whatever, you can, that's where you would see some sort of, you know, if you're partnering with a large studio, as far as independent. I mean, I'm kind of speaking out of my experience there.
Yeah. But those kind of things have kind of fallen off to the wayside. It's not the yeah. early 90s anymore where everybody like, yeah. you know, Paramount Vantage and Fox Searchlight and, you know, Focus Film, like all of these small little, independence where the money's at. So of course they all made their independent labels. Do you think the theatrical experience, would you agree that it's going to be different? Do you think that it's going to be the Disney studios? Do you think, you know, IMAX is going to be a thing? Like how it's
I think it was changing before January 2020. I mean, I noticed I'm a big fan of the movie theater subscription model mm-hmm. personally, because I like for $20, I can go to the movie theaters every weekend. Count me in. And maybe I'll buy an extra popcorn and, you know, get the movies. We'll make a little more money off of me. So I was already way on board with the subscription model. And then my AMC just recently switched over to all the, you know, the big chairs and the yeah. more spaced out stuff. I'm mm-hmm. like, yeah, this is what I'll pay extra to do this. So, I mean, we're no longer, it's not that, you know, sardines in a can kind of situation oh. where they used to squeeze everybody in a theater and the seats were like worse than, you know, airline seats, or they were the same as airline seats. But so I think that in that respect, but then again, there's a theater that does the second run theater.
Yeah.
Second whatever.
That, like a dollar theater. Yeah.
Dollar theater. And they used to always do like Rocky Horror every 3 or 4 months. And there's a little bit of that I'm like, I don't want to see that go away. You know, I want to be throwing popcorn at the screen and having just a crazy time in the theater. So, you know, maybe the dollar theaters model still kind of floats around as a sign. That doesn't mean you could have more than one, you know, model out there. So, yeah, it was changing, I think. I think with the recent COVID discussion about how we had to separate the seats and all that, it's going to be quite different, at least for at least for the rest of this year.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
I think for the foreseeable future, it's good.
I
think the next 2 or 3 years, this is going to be not exactly what we're going through right now, but there'll be different versions of this moving forward. I think COVID, I don't think, is going to go away it's going to be with us in one way, shape, or form. We're not eradicating it anytime in the near future. So,
and there's always the question of what's next after COVID. You know, what disease comes next that we all get?
Well, there's murder hornets, earthquakes, explosions. I mean, I'm sure there's a meteor on its way as we speak. Everyone bust out a Deep Impact and Armageddon so we can figure out how we deal with it.
Yeah.
But it's coming. It's coming.
The secret is oil drillers. That's how we get through the next.
No, let's not train astronauts to drill. Let's train drillers to be astronauts in 5 days. Yes, this makes all the sense in the world. But hell, what a hell of a romp of a film. I love Armageddon. Oh, yeah. It's a guilty pleasure.
That's going back a ways.
I mean, look, I'll watch Armageddon before I'll watch Deep Impact. Like, I watched Deep Impact once. I've seen Armageddon probably 10 times in my life. So,
what was it? Every Frame of Painting did a whole thing on Mayhem.
Oh, yeah.
That's a really good video, just discussion about it. I mean, he gets so little respect for being kind of just visually interesting. Oh. even though his storylines might be stupid, but you got to give it to him, man. He knows how to frame a shot.
I've said this publicly before, and I'll say it again. There's action films before Michael Bay, and there's action films after Michael Bay. And the same thing happened with Tony Scott. When Tony Scott showed up, there's action films before Tony. There's action shots, films after Tony. They shift the visual medium. Michael Bay, everybody wanted to look at their action films to look like Michael Bay. They just did. And you could see them. They copied the shots and they never got it right. And, you know, there's guys out there who remain nameless directors who really, really were on top of trying to exactly do what Michael Bay did and all this kind of stuff. Regardless, you love him or hate him. Like, The Rock is still probably my favorite Michael Bay film of all time. And it still holds up. It's probably the best story. But love him or hate him, you've got to respect the visual prowess of what he's been able to do. I mean, there is nobody in the history of film that did what he's done. You know, do I like all his films? No. But visually, I mean, he changed the game.
What was the last one he did for Netflix?
The one with Ryan Reynolds. Yeah, that wasn't bad. But you could tell it's Michael. Like, the second a frame shows up. Oh, yeah, that's it.
I mean, there's a lot of stupid stuff, but you're looking at it and like, whoa, I never thought you would do that in a frame. It's like, there's so much clever visual stuff that's going on. It's wrapped in some kind of silliness in my taste. But, like, I can appreciate the fact that there's just set pieces that are like, this is very creative. This is very ingenious. So,
yeah,
I end up really liking that movie.
Yeah,
I'm probably, I can't remember the name of it, but
oh, it's like six something six or something six, like that.
Yeah, something like that.
Something six. Yeah, it was like the six ghost guys out there doing what they do. Going real back to theaters real quick. I mean, I've always said that theaters have had a combative relationship with their customer base for a long. I mean, it's first of all, the experience used to suck. It was sardines, sticky floors, stale popcorn, and then they charge you inside $45 for a Coke, $75 for a popcorn. Like, it's like, it's almost like, airport food costs. So, and they never really cared a lot, but then slowly but surely, as their numbers started to go down, they're like, oh, wait a minute, we've got to create a better experience because we're not the only show in town anymore. And that's when these seats started showing up and bars like the AMC here in Burbank has like a bar inside of it. And it's like, you know, special seatings and the sound got better, but it's like, you know, for a certain generation, we all remember and they're still abusive. I still think they're abusive in their pricing. They're totally. Just so abusive in their pricing
for a beer. Come on, give me a break.
Yeah. So no, there's, still, that, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that the other day I was thinking about this and I forgot to mention it, but yeah, if this Disney owned, I mean, Disney's not going to lower the price, I think.
But their experience, look, when you walk into Disneyland or Disney World.
Oh yeah.
You just, my wife and I, every time we drive into the parking lot to one of those places, we just go, let the beating begin. Because you're just being charged like $25 for parking and you're boom, boom, boom. Yeah. Like, and you're in there, but the experience, they are offering you a very high quality experience for the most part. So that's what you get, but you don't get that with a standard movie theater. Have you ever been to the El Capitan?
No, I haven't. I need to go.
So when I went to El Capitan, I saw Frozen there with my daughters and they had like, the princess came out and did like a pre-show and there's this stuff. It was like, you know, it's Disney everything. And next door, there's a Disney store. And it's like this whole experience. And the price honestly wasn't much different than a normal movie theater. So I was like, okay, this makes sense.
Well, I think the point I was trying to make was that I think if let's say, let's not pick Disney, let's say like Amazon or something owns a studio or owns a theater, you might conceivably see a lowering of the costs of like concessions because traditionally the argument was that concessions is where the movie theater makes money. Well, if the movie theater is owned by the studio, then they're also making money on the ticket price.
Right.
So conceivably they can lower the, you know, popcorn being $7 for a small, maybe it's $5 for a small.
Mm-hmm. And that's still abusive. But
sure.
But it's $2-$3 less. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Agreed.
So That might be a benefit that comes out of it. I don't know.
We'll see. It's a different business model. I mean, since you're a business major, so if you look at the business models of theaters, they get, you know, 50% or, you know, 40% or 30%, depending on how big the movie is and the week it's coming out. So you get a small percentage of the box office. All their money is made at concessions. But if the studio owns the space, then they get 100% of the sales at the box office. And they get a little bit off of royalties, off of the concessions. But where they start making their money is off of ancillary products. And so if there's a Warner Brothers style theater chain, then there'd be all sorts of Warner Brothers. And you could buy the poster of the movie. You could buy all the merch for that movie that week. And it's rotating in and out every week. And it makes sense. That's a different business model than what we have currently. And it's going to change. There's just no – I mean, ArcLight. You've been to ArcLights, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they have that little store on the side that has like, you know, the movie memorabilia stuff. And sometimes they would bring out stuff. But it's kind of like almost – not a throwaway, but it's not themed out like a Warner Brothers or a Disney or even an Amazon theater would have, because with Amazon's data on people's buying habits, they know what products are going to be out there, and they're going to have you just walk in with your app, pick up the thing and walk out, and they charge your Amazon account. I mean, that's they have those stores now. They have the bookstore now, like that, the Amazon bookstore that you walk in.
Not to get sidetracked too much, but I'll just tell you a story about yesterday. I was returning something from Amazon. And I found out that Amazon has this Kohl's thing where you go into Kohl's and you just drop off your product. And I did that. And then the Kohl's said, thank you for dropping off. Here's a 25% coupon for Kohl's. And I was so impressed by it that I actually bought something. I was like, I need some sandals. And I just bought them. And I was like, this is such a brilliant idea, because it's a great service for me, because I don't have to package it. I don't have to take it to UPS. I don't have to worry about that. And it gets me in their store. And I got what I wanted. I needed some sandals. So I finally got my sandals and I got a coupon for it.
So for Kohl's, it's a little bit, you know, a little bit more hassle.
One person staff
to deal with it and more foot traffic. And Amazon's like, we need real estate. So we'll give you traffic. You give us the real estate. Well, it's a deal. It is fairly, fairly brilliant. Now let's talk a little bit about production, film production.
Okay.
What do you think it's going to look like? I mean, you're shooting now. Like, how is it working? You know, shooting with, you know, this COVID stuff. I mean, for one man crew or short, like two man crew is one thing, but like for narrative TV show, like I don't know how you move forward right now, at least.
I agree with you. I mean, I do one man, two man things, operations. I do, and well, I work with corporate clients, including school districts, and what, it just, it's a lot. I mean, I don't get, I don't want to sound too dangerously political, I guess, but it's a lot about optics. It's about appearing to look like you're doing. I mean, you wear the masks, you stay your, do your social distancing, you apply, apply the hand sanitizers and all that. But it really just comes down to, we just have to look like we're doing our jobs. And unfortunately, with when you get to larger narratives, when you have lots of groups of people, you know, hair, makeup and sets and all that, and just 30, 40 people crews, it's hard to maintain those optics. I mean, there's a whole movement about, you know, getting so many people trained in, you know, health and safety and having that one person on set. And look, is that really going to make that much a difference? Or is that, you're just kind of, it's just a CYA maneuver. I don't know. I don't see us really getting into like traditional, and this, I guess, was, look, I don't know if you've, you've probably been affected, but I think, I feel like a lot, the society in general has kind of had like overhanging depression because of all of this.
Yeah. You know? It was like, like Michelle Obama came out and she says she has low grade depression. And I think it was,
everyone does.
And I think what Seth Meyers said, like, when you go low, I go high. I have high grade depression. And it's very true. No, I don't know why I do this, but I watch the news every day. And I just watch 30 minutes of it. It just, I watch network news and I just watch it just to find out what's going on. Yeah. Just to stay informed, because we kind of got to know what's going on. I mean, because I never was a person who watched the news. Like, I'm like, you know what? If it's big enough, I'll hear about it. I'll find it on my Facebook feed, or someone will tell me about it. And now it's just like things are changing so rapidly and craziness is happening on a daily basis that you kind of have to stay informed. And, you know, I sit there with my wife, and I just turned to her, I'm like, why are we doing this? I don't you know, we're praying for that last segment, which is like how a puppy saved someone with COVID. Like it's like, that's, we're praying for that one happy moment at the end of the broadcast.
Yeah. That's the depressing, because I think, you know, if I try to put together like a small production, and I'm not throwing lots of money at it, I'm just going to, you know, put together a little short film or something. I can't really foreseeably do that in the next, you know, few months. Just because if I wanted to cast it, it would be difficult, because there's going to be half of your cast is probably saying, well, I'm not going to, or not even interested in working in something right now. They don't want to be in anything, you know, and I'm not going to be paying them like huge amounts of money. This is more of like a for fun project. How can you, it's hard to justify it, and it's hard to even look like you're doing, I'm watching old movies and thinking like, huh, I wish we could hug people like that did in a movie, because you can't do any of that stuff. Yeah, so I don't know what's going to happen.
Love scenes. How can you do a love scene?
No.
How can you do a fight? Like a fight.
Like a close combat fight. No, you can't do it.
I mean, I mean, someone like Tyler Perry, who has an infrastructure that makes all the sense in the world, he's popping out content like crazy. And he's a guy who creates content. Like, he creates like 50 episodes of a show in like 4 weeks or something like that.
His workflow is amazing. I mean,
pumps it out, but he has he is a unique person, because he has an entire movie studio at his disposal, which he can quarantine, lock it down, and everyone's in a bubble for that time and you can shoot. That makes sense. But no, we're not set up for that. Like, that's never been a thing. And that's in the studio world, let alone in the indie world. I actually did a whole episode about COVID safety, because I went for a bike ride and I saw, of course, independent filmmakers on the side of the road in my neighborhood shooting a short or some scenes that were COVID related, because the guys were dressed up in like, you know, hazmat suits and stuff.
Okay.
And when they had the hazmat suit off, but the head was off, they were all clunked together in a small group talking. The actors were all talking, and then the director and DP were setting something up over there, and nobody had masks on. And I'm like, this is so irresponsible. Like, you can't do that. Like, I couldn't, as a film director, put my cast or crew in harm's way right now for a film. Like, it's not worth it right now. It just doesn't make any sense to do something like that. I can't in good conscience.
I'll send it further too. I mean, look, I may not, if someone, and I'm not saying I disagree, but I'm saying if you think it's not an issue, you can't get other people to do it. You know what I mean? It's like, so you're just, unless you find like a bunch of people that all agree that, oh, we're going to take the risk, but that's not fun. That's not the point of making films. Want kind of diversity of opinion. So it's, we're all
independent film. Independent film is going to have a rough time for the next few years, and people are going to have to get very creative. You know, if they are going to do something, it's going to be, you know, kind of like what I did with my last film, which was, well, last film I couldn't do now is because going to Sundance and shooting at Sundance, which is something I can't do right now, but it was a small crew. Yeah. It was a three man crew. It was me, the DP and the sound guy, and then my actors. And that was it. And I was running around. So you have to start getting creative in the storytelling process on how to do it. Like, I've been hearing from the studios, people in the studios, that they're saying, when you're writing, no crowds. Don't put this in. Don't put that in anymore. No more love scenes. Figure out another way to do it. If we're going to continue to move. So I think there's going to be a COVID era in filmmaking where after we're done with everything that's in the can, we're going to start seeing films and television shows that are going to be just like, oh, that was in the COVID era. And it's going to be like, they can't kiss, they can't touch. It's like this whole weird thing. But I think that's what's going to happen. And independent film, I think, I'm waiting for the next great COVID era independent film, like the El Mariachi of this era. I don't know what that will be, you know, that's going to like take the world by storm, like the paranormal, like Paranormal Activity, perfect COVID movie, like. Perfect COVID movie. Well, like, you can shoot
in bed together, though. That's a problem.
No. But if they've quarantined together, they're fine.
Okay, gotcha.
So again, but this is a small crew, very small amount. You know, if you quarantine with somebody for 2 weeks and we're all good. All right, great. Let's go. And we're all in a house and it's very controlled. And that's the kind of films I think we're going to be seeing coming out.
Yeah. I always think about like what will future generations look back and ask us, you know, like, oh, you lived through that era. What was it like? It's it's going to be an interesting story to tell the grandkids.
So I want to go back real quick to Filmmaker IQ, man, because I love what you do with Filmmaker IQ. You've created some amazing. Okay. I've promoted your stuff over the years, as far as those little mini documentaries you make over, like, you know, a lens, depth of field, the 180 rule, like, and then all, you know, all this color and 28 frames and 24 frames a second, all this kind of stuff. Why do you do it? Because it's a lot of work, dude. It's a ton. You've got the little 3D image, the 3D guys coming out, setting all that. I mean, to create a 15-minute video must take you forever.
Well, the last video I did started at the beginning of the COVID thing was that Fox video, history of William Fox. It ended up being like 43 minutes long. And it was a ton of research just trying to go. It's a self-expression kind of a thing. I really enjoy exploring the truth of a topic like that and kind of going in depth into it. Cause I feel like no one else is really kind of tackling it the way that I do, which is just unrelenting depth.
obscene depth. 15 minutes on focus, like, or on depth of field. Oh, I think like 15 minutes of that. Like, it was like, but it's so entertaining. And like, you go into the history of it and it's like the lenses and the breakdowns. Oh, it's great.
And of which I will get like plenty of YouTube comments that will argue with me and tell me I'm completely wrong because I have not done the research.
Obviously.
It's also born. I think I have an internet forum personality where I do like to go on. I unfortunately read all the comments and I engage in.
Don't do that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a habit. It's part of who I am. A lot of stuff drives sometimes the ideas for new content was based on, oh, that person made a mistake about that. So I want to talk about that particular point, you know, but it's kind of in that range. That's you know, I want to get to the point where I can no longer read comments because there's too many of them. That's my goal. But until then, I'm stuck arguing about 24 frames a second every day.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, and the depth that you do in these videos is pretty insane. And the research that goes into them is insane. The production of them. And again, you've been doing this for years now, over a decade.
Yeah.
You know, you've been doing, cause some of some of those little documentaries, the ones with the little dude, I call them the little dudes. I don't know if you haven't specifically. Dudes,
yeah.
The little 3D dudes, they go back 7-8 years.
Yeah, about 8 years. That's when we started doing the videos, because when we first started Filmmaker IQ, it was more of an aggregator site, a blog site. Mm-hmm. And we would do like what all the other bloggers do, is just go out and try to find articles and post them together. Mm-hmm. And just the funny thing is, if you do that long enough, you kind of get a very good sense of what the blogosphere looks like. And you get kind of disgusted by it, like, I've seen the same thing over again. So we decided at that point, like, we should start making our own stuff instead of relying on other people to make stuff. So that's when the videos started happening. And the first one was like Dolly Zoom when I first explored that topic. But yeah, but I think what it is I've talked to some people about this, but I feel like filmmakers have like 80% of filmmakers have an expiration date of like, say, I want to say like 3 or 4 years. It's like, I think 3 or 4 years it takes to learn everything about filmmaking. And it's still that fun. Like exciting. Oh, I get to learn about this camera. This new camera's coming out. So about 3 or 4 years, you absorb all this information. And then after that, you either, if you love it, you continue on and you pursue like story and you pursue creation of actual, and you said a product, you know, you get over the this is exciting. We're just learning thing. And then the other segment of the population just loses interest and they disappear. So I feel like a lot of what the growth in the internet is capturing that first like 3 or 4 years of people that are just starting to learn this stuff. And what's scary about that is there's so much marketing, there's so much like you know, the manufacturers are shoving down marketing information down your throat. I'm gonna pick on them. Blackmagic just came
out. I knew you were gonna say Blackmagic.
You know, 12K camera, and they're saying it's revolutionary, it doesn't have a Bayer system. And I'm sitting back here thinking, the Bayer system's a good thing. There's people online saying the Bayer system sucks now because this new marketing is coming down and slapping them with this new, we got this new system of camera. So I don't know where I'm going with all of this.
Well, I mean, but it started with Red. Red was the one that first came out with 4K and just like exploded. I remember at NAB when it was a box. It was a box. And they're like, just give us $10,000 and you will get a camera one day. And like, that was insane. And they sold like whatever, 500 cameras that during NAB at that time. And they changed the game. Red changed the game. Love them or hate them, they changed the game. Mm-hmm. Arri took a while to catch up. And now people argue all the time. Arri's better than Red. Sony's better than Arri. And Blackmagic is now, you know, Blackmagic was like kind of the redheaded stepchild for a long time. And now they've kind of come into their own as a real player in the camera game, you know. And I've always said, personally, I love Blackmagic. I've shot Blackmagic. I've shot both my features on them. And I love Blackmagic cameras and DaVinci. I edit on Resolve and, you know, I drank the Kool-Aid because I feel that they have the best bang for the buck. I think out of all the cinematic cameras, I think they have the best bang for the buck. And I did some tests once and I shot an Arri down the middle, an Arri Alexa down the middle, and I shot the 4.6K Blackmagic down the middle. And I put them up and I brought in some filmmakers and some DPs. I'm like, which is which? And 9 out of 10 times they could not tell the difference, because the Blackmagic image, it lit the same, everything was same, same lenses, same everything. The image is equivalent. It's not, and I know a lot of people are going to be like, no, what are you saying? I'm like, no, listen, calm the hell down. Where the cost, the reason why the Alexa costs so much more is when you start going 3 or 4 stops under, 5 stops under, it falls apart. The Blackmagic falls apart. But if you shoot it like you're supposed to shoot it, it's pretty damn good. And the cost versus like 80,000 versus this, a really easy workflow versus a fairly intense workflow in post. All of that, you just got to kind of look. And now the 12K, what is it? How much does it cost? $10,000,
yeah.
I'm not going to get it. I'm fine with my – I have a 4.6. I'm good.
It's an interesting camera. The thing is, I've seen a lot of people jump on board with it. And it's just – I don't feel like the existence of a 12K camera does not invalidate your 4.6K
Absolutely.
Camera.
Right.
You know, but it feels like a lot of people are thinking that. And
that's marketing.
I mean, it's not. And look, Grant Petty's he did a good job on his video, but I think it's the next layer. It's the people that talk about what he said that are kind of overhyping it. And that's what bugs me about kind of marketing. And that's kind of what I've tried to do with my videos a little bit, is trying to get down to the fundamentals, get down to the understanding of what does it mean when they say Bayer system, or what Bayer pattern. You know, what does that mean? And then kind of cut through some of that marketing hype that you're just constantly inundated with. And that's kind of what I'm trying to do with some of these videos.
So like, yeah, when Blackmagic came out with the 4K, the little mini pocket 4K, then that everybody was like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, it's a pocket 4K. And then like 4 months later, the 6K comes out. And I'm like, are you kidding me, guys? Are you effing kidding me? Really?
Yeah.
Like, can you stop it? Can you just not do? And I know the Blackmagic guys. I've worked with Blackmagic. I yell at them all the time. I'll go like, dude, seriously, man. Like, just give us a year. Give us like some time to like enjoy what we have. Like,
I'll give you a better one. I have the Atom Mini, which I bought early this year. Then it came with the Atom Mini Pro, which I bought because I need that multicam view, which is what it added to the system. And then a month later, the week I got it, after being on back order for a month, they announced the Atom Mini Pro ISO, which can record all your camera streams at the same time. So it's like literally a month after I got this thing, a brand new one came out. And I'm looking at it like, that's a great feature to have. Do I need it? Not really. But man, I wish I had that option. That's the thing, is that you have to get used to the fact that, hey, you know what? I need to stop buying technology and make stuff with the stuff I have had purchased.
Amen.
That's what I need to do.
Well, I think a lot of filmmakers use technology as an excuse not to actually get into the arena.
Yeah, that's so true.
I mean, so many filmmakers just like, oh, I can't shoot it because I need this camera. Or I can't shoot it because I need that camera.
When people argue with me about 24 frames a second, and people say that they want a high frame rate of movies, I always say, go out there and shoot them yourself. Like, you be the change. You go out. And then every single time they always tell me, I can't because I don't have any of this. I don't have any equipment. I don't have any casserole. So it's always an excuse to get out of making something.
Well, listen, man. I mean, I've been a filmmaker for 25 years plus, and I understand the excuse demon, because it's fear. We're fearful of putting ourselves out there. We're fearful of creating art, and oh my God, no one's gonna like it. The comments, holy cow, yeah. All of that kind of stuff, and not to mention the pressure of, if it's, you know, the cost and people you're working with, and can I really do it, and all of the, there's so many doubts and fears that we as filmmakers have, that we find whatever excuse. Look, same thing happens with screenwriters. That's like, oh, I'll write tomorrow. There's fear as an artist in general. There's always fear. And gear is one of the easiest things you can say, like, oh, I don't have this camera, I don't have that camera, or I don't have this lighting, oh, I need that location, or I can't make this script without $3 million. Like, I can't, I can't. Not to say I'm not going to go write a script that can make for $10,000. But this script I can't make, so I'm going to just sit around for 3 years chasing money for it. And that makes me feel like I'm a filmmaker, but you're really not a filmmaker. You're just a guy or a gal chasing money that will more than likely never happen. And I played that game for 20 years. Yeah. 20 years I played that game. Till I turned 40, and I was attached to another big project with a big producer and screenwriter, and the project fell apart again. And I said, I'm 40. I can't do this anymore. So 30 days later, I was shooting my first feature with a Blackmagic Cinema 2.5K. Why? Because I had it.
Did you have?
Yeah. And I didn't even hire a DP. I lit the damn thing myself, and I never really DP'd before. I was a colorist for 10 years. So I felt that I could get it. I just gave me it down the middle. I'll fix it in post. And I did.
You're inspiring me, Alex. Man, I need to get on my button. Something.
But I did. But
I love that story.
But the thing is that I didn't. I made it because I was already with Indie Film Hustle at that time. So I felt very comfortable for whatever. It was something psychological, but I just felt, oh, I have Indie Film Hustle I can go back to. Like I have my, mm-hmm. I have my tribe. So if it doesn't work out, no big deal. Because I don't know about you, but in my mind, when I made my first feature, it was going to be Reservoir Dogs. I mean, I don't know about you, but it was going to be Reservoir Dogs. It was going to be Mariachi. It was going to be Clerks. It was going to be one of these big independent sure. films that explode out of the gate. So that pressure that I put on myself stifled me for 20 years. And of course I was fearful. And of course I was chasing every other dream and every other little project and everything else because I was scared to actually go do it. Whereas when I finally just said, you know what, screw it. I'm going to just go out and shoot it. 30 days later, we shot with a scriptment, which was a you know, 8-page outline with a bunch of stand-up comics and improvisers. And we shot around our, we shot at all their apartments and around LA. And we shot the whole damn thing in 8 days. I went up to the Hollywood sign and stole it. which by the way, anyone wanting to shoot on the Hollywood sign, this is a little tip if you just want to, because if you want to get yeah. permits and stuff, it becomes a pain in the ass. But, yeah. So I was like, I'm just going to steal it. And like halfway, and we were really, so I was scared. Like, oh my God, what do we get? This is the Hollywood sign. Oh my God. Halfway yeah. up, while I'm lugging the gear up with my actress is walking in front of me and I've got all this gear that I'm lugging up. And I said, no one's coming. No one cares.
No one cares.
No one cares. Like if someone called them, hey, someone's illegally shooting they're not helicoptering somebody in. By the time they get up there, I'm done with my shot. So yeah. I just realized, I'm like, oh, okay, fine. I could just shoot. And we shot and it was all these cool images and stuff that we got up there. But I didn't give my mind a moment to stop itself because yeah. it was afraid. And I just did it and I was done and I got it out there and it sold to Hulu and we sold it internationally and we did very well with it. And it was cost like $5,000 to make and it was great. But that was, it took me 20 years to get there because of yeah. the fear. And I think gear was one of the, oh man, I need a Red. I can't. I need a Red. I can't.
I need Alexa. I need to have all this stuff.
Oh, I need a Techno. How can I not shoot without a Techno?
No, of course not.
Have you ever shot with a Techno, by the way?
No, I've seen them, but I never touched.
I was shooting a music video and I had a Techno the entire day. First time I ever had one. Oh my God, it's so amazing.
Yeah, that.
it's just, it lived on the tech all day. I can't shoot without a mini Techno everywhere I go. It was so amazing to have that thing. I was just like, oh, I get why James Cameron has like 20 of these on the set just in case. But anyway, so that's the fear thing. So I think gear is that.
Expand it because we kind of talking about gear, fear of gear, but I think it's also the fear of actually materializing your idea. Because as long as it's an idea in your head, it's brilliant, it's perfect. You know, the movie in your head is Oscar winning. You put it on paper, and then you start realizing, oh crap, maybe it's not that good.
And then you start shooting. Ooh. Maybe.
Yeah. Or you see it. Oh crap. This isn't really as good as I thought it was going to be. It's a fear. No, it is.
It's scary, man. It's scary being a filmmaker and doing all that. But you know, anyone listening out there, I hope they don't get caught up that because tomorrow you'll wake up and you'll be, you know, 70 and you'll be yeah. still chasing that Hollywood dream that Hollywood sells you that is bogus. It's the sizzle. There's yeah. no steak behind it. And you kind of just got to go out and do it. Like my second film, I shot with the pocket camera, 1080p. The mm-hmm. first generation pocket camera. I shot the whole movie yeah. on that. People thought I was crazy. I thought it was crazy to shoot a whole film on that. I'm like, no, I love the look of it. It looks great. Uh-huh. And it was a 1080p camera, right? Blew it up to 2K for my DCP, screened it at the Chinese theater. It's one of the best things I've ever shot in my life. It was beautifully shot. I was like, I was scared to death because on my 55 inch, you know, a color grading monitor, it looked great. I'm like, yeah, but this yeah. is, you know, projection. And like, I don't know. And the first time I saw it was at the Chinese theater projected theatrically. I was like, holy cow, it holds. Like, I thought it was going to get pigs. Like, it held so beautifully. So I don't want to hear excuses from people like, oh, this and that. And if you want to go to Tangerine with the iPhone and
right.
it, just worry about your story. People will mm-hmm. forgive the image quality and don't get caught up in like, you're not Deakins. Like, you're not Deakins. Anyone listening, you're not Roger Deakins. You're not going to make something look like Roger Deakins. I'm sorry. It's because there's one Roger Deakins. You're not going to be Fincher. You're not going to be Nolan. You're not going to be Spielberg, because that's what they do. And it took them years, if not decades, to get to where they are. Be yourself and be the best version of yourself that you can be. And that's all we could ever do as a filmmaker.
That's a fantastic message. Now, Deakins doesn't work alone. He's got, you know, script or set dressers. He's got, you know, location scouts and all the resources at his disposal. Yeah. But I was going to say that, and this might sound a little narcissistic, but if it was between me and Steven Spielberg, and Steven Spielberg was given like 15 minutes to work a scene and shoot it, and I was given 8 hours to shoot the scene, and I had the same people that Steven Spielberg has, I think I would probably hold up. At least I wouldn't embarrass myself, I think.
You get something competent up there. It'd be something there. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I know what you're saying. You're not saying that you're Steven Spielberg, nor that you can compete at that level because he's Steven Spielberg. No one can.
Exactly.
But if you use the same crew, the same resources, chances are your stuff is going to look
It would be more John Hess than it would be Steven Spielberg, but it would still be okay. I mean, it's especially given a time difference. If I had a lot more time than Steven Spielberg, I might pull off something.
It's something that looks really good. Something that looks really good. And then before we go, man, I got to ask you, Cats.
Oh, okay.
Cats. I mean, come on. Let's.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Cats for a second, because you did a video about that you like Cats. And I've spoken about Cats publicly many times.
Okay.
And I generally don't like to bash other filmmakers on the show. And I'm not bashing the filmmaker. Something happened, in my opinion. I don't know what it was, because it was such a perfect storm that you will never see in your lifetime again, because you had Spielberg producing. You had an Oscar winner directing it. You had – based on one of the biggest Broadway shows of all time with the biggest – music stars of all time, some Oscar, like they were throwing Oscar winners around like it was water on that set.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone drank the Kool-Aid. Like, everyone said, this is going to be huge. This is a great idea. That doesn't happen. You know, you get The Room every once in a while. Like, you'll get The Room, you'll get a Showgirls, you'll get a Trolls 2, you'll get something that's so bad that it transcends being good. I'm still not at the point where Cats transcends to being good. I got through 20 minutes of it and I just said, oh my God, this is so bad. I can't keep going. Maybe with a group of people, I could watch it again, but The Room, I could watch again and again, but I can't watch Cats.
Well, I think with Cats, I think what to me is I really liked basically the garishness of it is part of it. You know, the first 20 minutes is when you have the Jenny Anydot sequence, when you have the kids and the cockroaches.
Oh,
that is a bridge too far. That's the worst part of the movie. I guarantee.
Oh, it gets better. It gets better. It gets better. Oh, okay.
Totally. It is totally like once you get past that.
You mean once you get past the dancing cockroaches?
With children's faces.
But that's the thing. I just want to impress upon everyone listening is that this was a universal movie with Spielberg producing it, like with $100 million behind it. This doesn't happen. These studios don't take risks like this.
But on paper,
this was a sure fire hit. Like, this was a hit on paper. It checked every single box off. The one thing it did not check off was the cat anuses that were in it, and the unfinished hands and visual effects that released it with. It was, oh God.
I didn't even notice the hands part, but I think what I appreciate with Cats though is it adds something to the musical genre that has been missing for a long time. And that's actually having some people involved that are, and again, I'm looking past the effects, which I think I just kind of got, it's like a hot tub. You kind of get used to it after a while. For
me, at least. That was great. It's a great analogy. Like, after a while, it's really hot when you get in, but after a while, it just waves over
it's okay.
you.
It's fine. It's like the ocean. But yeah, I think you got like all these, a lot of the more major roles of Cat. And again, like I got, this is an admission that I am a big Cats fan before the movie came out. So I knew the, there's not a story. It's a collection of songs. It's really what it is. It's based on poems by T.S. Eliot. Right. So I mean, I have that background of it. So I knew the characterizations. But you have a lot of people that are in the musical genre that don't, because the musical genre is for a long time has been plagued by the fact that you have to have the paper. The paper has to say, you know, we have this star and it's going to bring this much box off, this star. And the problem with, you know, that is Johnny Depp, for example, in Sweeney Todd, he's not really a good singer, not for that particular role. That's so what Cats did, which was kind of unique, was that they got a lot of people in the leads that aren't household names, that are from like the Royal Ballet Company, which was like, wow, we're actually bringing in people that are good artists. Now we covered them with fake fur, but
and those sets,
at least they brought in some good art. If you were to only watch one segment and just kind of ignore the rest of it, if you watch the Skimbleshanks, the Railway Cat, and this is sounding absurd now. If you watch just that segment. And you can.
It's not too bad.
It's actually very good because it's probably the best segment in the entire film. It's not like disturbing. There's no children on cockroaches, but it's actually you see some very very high level dancing on display. Oh. It's something you don't actually see in movies. So I'll give the filmmaker credit for that.
It's lit beautifully. The dancing's great. The singing is fantastic. The songs are the songs. They're great, you know. What a genius little cat, whatever the hell that thing is called. Angelical cat. The first 8 minutes of the movie is just one long ass song. And my wife looked at me. She's like, is this going to stop anytime soon? I'm like, no, it's not. It's not. And the best review I've ever heard for a movie was for Cats. And it's one sentence, which is so perfect. Cats is the worst thing to happen to cats since dogs. It's just absolute. But it's been bashed enough in the press. But I just wanted to hear your point of view. So I appreciate that. Anyone out there, please watch Cats. Let us know what you think in the comments below.
It helps if you go into it maybe a little inebriated.
Oh, no. I'm halfway through, like in those first 20 minutes, I'm like, man, I don't drink or I don't smoke. I've never done drugs. But I'm like, if I was high, this would be much better. Like I could, like if you're tripping, again, have never tripped, but if I could only imagine, like if I was tripping, this movie would blow my mind.
It is one of those in the mood movies. Again, the thing is, I'm also a huge fan of Andrew Lloyd Webber, who's obviously wrote Cats, but Andrew Lloyd Webber in his earlier years, you have to realize the guy was. There was some weird stuff he put out. Really weird. Cats is in that category. In that category.
Hey-o. Now I'm going to ask you a couple questions to ask all my guests.
Yeah, sure.
What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Oh, my Lord. I could be very, very facetious and say quit. just
run away. Just stop.
Run away. Because if you follow that advice, then you probably made a good decision. If you said, no, John, you're an idiot, I don't want to listen to you, then you probably have the right mindset for for sticking it out in this business, because it is hard. I think, but be less facetious, I think, is to really understand what you're trying to put out there. I think a lot of people get so narrow. So they put the blinders on, they think about their project, their movie, and they think it is so perfect for everybody and everyone will love my movie because I'm the one that made it. And I actually had somebody send me a question the other day. He asked me, what do they mean by target audience? And I had to ask myself, like, how do you not understand what your target? So I just kind of went through with him. It's like, who does your movie appeal to? Who do you think would want to see your movie? And I think that's, if that's any advice, maybe it's just to understand not only like what are you making your movie, not necessarily for who you're making the movie, but or how does it fit in the larger world, you know? Mm-hmm. And also realize too that you don't necessarily make movies for the entire world. A lot of times you make a movie for yourself first, but also realize that fact that you know, try to tie that into. I mean, I try that in. Make the movie for yourself, but also realize that how to appeal to other people. If that makes sense,
makes perfect.
It's a long...
understand who your audience is, basically, and try to create something for that audience is a good piece of advice.
Yeah, and I think again, the audience could be you too. I mean, you are in the audience. You are the first audience. So if it doesn't appeal to you, then obviously it's not. I mean, if it doesn't appeal to you, you're gonna have trouble appealing it to somebody else.
And three of your favorite films of all time.
Oh, that's Doctor Strangelove is probably one of my favorites of all time. I'm not gonna go Cats, by what you may think. It's not even near the top 10. I'm trying to think of the Doctor Strangelove is absolutely my favorite. Oh, I love Some Like It Hot.
Yeah,
I just love
it. That was a great film. Such a great film.
I was gonna pick another one that it's kind of a more of a smaller one. This is kind of what really inspired me to be a filmmaker is a movie called The Big Kahuna.
Yeah, I remember the Big Kahuna.
Kevin Spacey.
Yep.
Danny DeVito and the guy that played the one of the vampires on Twilight. went on to I forget his name.
I know who you're talking about. Yeah, yeah.
And it's a great little movie from the late 90s. It's about these three salesmen that get together and they're trying to land the Big Kahuna, and it's entirely driven by conversation and entirely takes place in a single room, and it is some of the best performances I've ever seen on film. So I think that's one of my favorites.
Very cool.
I'll put that out there.
Now, where can people find you?
FilmmakerIQ.com. I am redoing the website eventually. It's a long process, but if you really want to find me, youtube.com/FilmmakerIQ is just look up FilmmakerIQ. Mm-hmm. You can chase me around on Facebook. I mean, I post more like personal stuff on Facebook, but between those two, that's really where you're going to see most of my face. And obviously on this podcast.
John, I really appreciate it. You coming on the show, man. Sure. We could talk for probably another 2-3 hours. Just geeking out alone on Cats. Yeah. But I really appreciate what you do, man, and all the education you put out there for filmmakers out there. So thank you for doing what you do, my friend.
Well, thank you for having me.
I want to thank John for coming on the show and dropping his filmmaker IQ on the tribe today. Thank you so much, John. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/433. And guys, if you haven't already, please head over to filmmakingpodcast.com and leave a good review for the show. It really helps us out a lot. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for listening. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.